A new chapter in world history and in the formation of Am Yisrael. Horatius dealt primarily with people, with individuals. Shmuz takes a step back and provides a broader perspective of the emerging nation. Perhaps we can suggest that as the parashas of Horatius span the life of a person in the individual sense, Shmuz is the culmination of an individual's legacy that has created a new generation following his or her ideals, goals, and life's aspirations. Rav Kupperman was the Ish Yasha, who not only lived for himself and his family, but lived for the whole of Klal Yisrael. As a result of his life's work, thousands of Talmidim have created their own families and are writing their own legacies based on the Torah ideals that permeated through the walls of Michala. Despite the fact that Rav Kupperman may no longer be with us physically, his timeless lessons echo across the world through the fruits of his labor. Rav Yaakov Galinsky relates a powerful incident which left a lasting impression. The episode took place in a Siberian slave labor camp where Rav Galinsky and so many of our brethren suffered unbearable and inhumane pain and misery. The Russians did not single out Jews as the only enemies of the state. Whoever had the misfortune of falling into their clutches were imprisoned and relegated to performing backbreaking labor under the most brutal conditions. After a full day's work, the men would trudge back to their barracks to lay down on their wooden bunks and attempt to fall into a fitful, painful sleep. Every night, at approximately 2 a.m., one of the Polish prisoners would arise from his bed and remove a bag that was hidden underneath it. He quickly removed what appeared to be some kind of a uniform, put it on, look at himself in the mirror, quickly remove the suit, return it to the bag, and go back to sleep. This went on night after night after night. While Rav Galinsky was used to seeing and hearing strange things in prison, this man's actions were extremely puzzling. Sleep was very important for a prisoner's well-being. To force himself to get up in the middle of the night just to put on a suit seemed really irrational. There had to be an explanation that would shed some light on this man's strange behavior. One day, when they were alone, Rav Galinsky approached the man and asked him to explain what was going on. "Why'd you get up in the middle of the night to put on your suit and view yourself in the mirror? Don't you value your sleep to keep up with your energy?" "Yes, Rabbi, my sleep is very important to me, but so is my sanity and my dignity. Let me explain. Prior to being taken captive by our Russian tormentors, I was a distinguished general in the Polish army. I had the respect of thousands of soldiers. Suddenly, our army was vanquished, and I became a prisoner. The degradation and deprivation to which they subject us to, in my opinion, is greater danger than the physical blows that rain upon us and our bodies every single day. At all costs, I have to prevent myself from getting into my head and from them getting into my head and destroying it. Therefore, every night when everybody's asleep, I risk removing my general's uniform, which has remained in my possession, and I don it, and I look in the mirror, and I remind myself, for 2 minutes, of my position and my status. I don't see a broken-down, fallen prisoner. I see a general in the Polish army. This is how I am able to maintain my sanity." Instantly, Rav Galinsky began to cry, and he said, "This is a message for me. We don't remember who we are. Ask the average Jew in the world today who the mother of Yoshka is, and he'll tell you. But sadly, ask him who Moshe Rabbeinu's mother was, and he'll have absolutely no clue whatsoever. In a world with so many external influences trying to seep into our existence and pollute our neshamas, there is an oasis. The protection and guidance of Michlala and its faculty that were guided and led by Rav Kupperman for so many decades helped us transcend the society in which we all live today. Michlala helped us understand that we are all daughters of the King of all Kings, Abbas Melech, that needs to imagine that she is standing in front of a mirror as Hashem's princess. With confidence and pride, we were given the tools and skills to go out into the world, being proud of our royal status and spreading the lessons across the globe. Rav Kupperman made us feel important, capable, and worthy of taking on such a royal position. At the Levaya, one of the Masvidim related the following story. One day, after the Daf HaYomi Shir Rav Kupperman attended, he made the following remark to the Magid Shir: "I've been blessed with Siyata Deshmaya, to have done a lot in my lifetime, but the accomplishment that I will take with me to Olam Haba is that my children and grandchildren are all Talmidei Chachamim and Oseikim BaTorah." Perhaps we can add that Rav Kupperman's Torah was given to us for Ahava, with love, and it created a close relationship between him and his Talmidos. There's a general principle in teaching Torah subjects that students are thought of as the children of the teacher. Only Torah creates this kind of relationship. As Serena Miller, one of his Machal students, mentioned, Rav Kushner made it clear that he considered every single woman in Mechvara one of his daughters.
That sounds right.
Therefore, we too can consider his children. So let's now hear an excerpt from Rav Kushner himself about how it all began. no one understood that. I did, or until most, I'm sure everyone did, but if there was anyone that didn't, I did ask for something in English, but nobody, sorry about that. Okay. I never had the stress of being taught by Rob Burstein, as I left Nephila just before he arrived. However, I know that every Tommy Dale that passed through his classes cherished the wisdom and unique insights that flowed from his mouth. It is auspicious that despite not having learnt directly from Rob Burstein, I, along with thousands of others, were inspired weekly in this very shul by his illustrious father, Rabbi Isaac Burstein. Rabbi Burstein has continued in his father's footsteps, and his name is renowned across the globe. He is a distinguished author of both Hebrew and English books, publishing many works on Chumash, Gemara, and Tefillah. Additionally, Rav Bernstein offers weekly shiurim that are open to the public. He currently lives in Yerushalayim, if I've done my homework correctly. Yes, and we're so grateful that he's made the trip to be with us today and to meet his family. Rav Bernstein tonight is going to share his wisdom on the earliest commentary on the Chumash. Yes? So, thank you very much.
In fact, my father was his first student back in Ireland when Rav Kupperman was yet in college, university. He was 17, 18 at the time, which means my father was 7 or 8. He had a weekly chavrusa, and Rav Kupperman used to pay my father to learn with him. I think tuppence a week. He was his first student. My father would later remark that teacher salaries never really progressed beyond that point. There's a great deal, of course, to say about Rav Kupperman. We could continue until he gives my Krishna to the chakras, and perhaps at the end we'll say some of the things which I think are pertinent and relevant. But the business of the day is Divrei Torah. That's what Dr. Rosenmasser directed. And I'm sure that's what Rav Kupperman himself would have preferred. And so, the topic that we will explore this evening, Mirat Hashem, is the earliest commentary on the Chumash. And that's rather an intriguing title, say so myself. And, of course, we're wondering, number one, what is the earliest commentary on the Chumash? And number two, can I get a discount? Well, the place to begin is as follows. If we take a look at source number one, and it's in Maseches Yuma, Daf Lamedes. And it's in Aramaic. We'll proceed with discretion and read and translate, and we'll kind of get the idea. So the Gemara begins as follows. Amar le Rabina. Rabina said, Lahu mirabonam, to one of the rabbis, to have a Mesader Agadata Kameh, who used to teach Agadas before Rabina. He asked the following, Mina Hamilta, what is the source of this idea? De Amar Rabbanan, that the rabbis say, Zeche Tzadik Livracha. I'm sure you've all heard that expression, Zeche Tzadik Livracha, and maybe you've wondered where it comes from. Well, the answer is, as he himself says, it's a pasuk in Mishlei, Zeche Tzadik Livracha. So Amar Lei, he responds with, and says, the Haktiv, it's a pasuk, Zeche Tzadik Livracha. So far, so good. In fact, this is, if we would pause the Gemara here, I think this is one of the moments where you kind of read it and think, well, I wish I was there, I could have said that too. But Ravina continues. And Ravina says, Mida Oraisa Minama. When I was saying, when I was asking, what is the source for the idea of Zecher Tzadik Livracha, I meant, what's the source in the Torah? In the Chumash? Ah, that's a different question. And, well, he was ready for him. Dichtiv, he said the source is as follows. V'ashem amar hamachaseni me'Abraham asher anu oseh. Now those words are taken, as you may recognize them, from Parshas Vayera, just before Hashem is about to destroy Sodom. But he tells Avram, I've got to tell Avram. Am I withholding from Avram that which I'm about to do? And of course, he proceeds to tell it. I'm just going to destroy Sodom. And then begins the longest conversation we ever have from Abraham in the Torah. Borrowing for Sodom. 50, 55, down to 10. But the point is, Hashem says, I'm covering, withholding from Abraham what I'm about to do. Uktiv, and the next pasuk says, Va'avraham hayom yihyeh legoy gadol v'atzum. Abraham will be a great nation. And says the Gemara, what's that got to do with anything? We're not talking about Avram, we're talking about Sodom. You see, says the Gemara, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Hashem mentioned Avram, and having mentioned him, he then proceeded, before moving on, he interjected words of bracha. Avram would be a great nation. Interestingly, parenthetically, the Gemara did not present what we may be more familiar with as an example of Zecher Tzadik Livracha in the Torah, and that is the beginning of Parshas Noach. Ele told us Noach is Tzadik. We spoke about Noach, and then we spoke about his children, but then we paused to speak about him with Rashi. However, his hero, Sefer Mishvoto, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So that's an interesting shaila. We normally try and draw the principle from the earliest possible place in the Torah. And we skipped over Noah, so to speak, and went to Avram. Well, that's a question for perhaps another time. Or if you remember from Parsha class, we dealt with that with the Maskil of David. But to the business at hand. That's the source in the Torah of Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Avram. And actually, I think it's fair to say that in this discussion in the Gemara, it's more important to pay attention to the question than it is to the answer. And the reason why is that if you ask me, where is it in the Torah, so if I know the answer, I'll tell you. And if I know it, then good, and now you know it, and that's even better. But the question is really the fulcrum here. It's really the focal point. And the reason why is, let's ask a question about the question. He's saying, okay, I know it's in Mishlei, but where is it in the Chumash? So here's my question. If you don't know where it is in the Chumash, how do you know it's there? Maybe it's not there. The one who knows where it is, so he knows that it's there. But you don't know where it is. How do you know it's there? Maybe it's not there. Maybe it's just in Mishnah. So I think the question is fascinating. Where is it in the Torah? How do you know it's in the Torah? The answer is, and what we see from between the lines here in this Gemara, is that it was clear to Ravina. If it's a pasuk in Mishlei, it has to be in the Torah. It's not possible that it's not in the Torah. It's axiomatically clear that anything that isn't formulated or expressed as a pasuk in Mishlei, you'll find it in the Torah. Anything that's a pasuk anywhere, you'll find it in the Torah. I just don't know where. That's where you come in. Please tell me. And then you told it. But the fact that it's there is clear. And what's the point? If we say that backwards, if you say that anything that's in the Apostle in the Vehem Ksubim must be in the Chumash, then really what you're saying is there is nothing in the Vehem Ksubim that isn't already in the Chumash. In which case, what are Nevi'im and Ksubim if everything's already in the Chumash? The answer is, they are presented and elucidated and extracted and formulated things that are in the Chumash and presenting them to you as formal ideas, as clarified ideas. And really what that leads us to is to an understanding that the earliest commentary on the Chumash is the Navi. The central role of Nevi'im and Ksubim is to explicate and elucidate things that are in the Chumash. They are the first Perush on the Torah. And that means the relationship of Torah to Nevi'im and Ksubim is that Torah contains all these things, and sometimes it's hard to see them. Nevi'im and Ksubim will work them up for us and present them. And this is an idea which is even further corroborated as we move to the second source, which is again in the Gemara. I had an interesting meeting with a colleague of mine. I met him, I said, I'm doing a source sheet about how Nevi'im and Ksubim is the Perush on the Torah. He said, oh, I guess there's lots of quotations for Nevi'im and Ksubim. And I said, actually, they're all Gemaras. But for a good cause, as we'll see. So the second source is Maseches Tanis on Daf Tes. And the Gemara relates, Ashkeke Rabbi Yochanan found the Yenuk of the Reish Lakish. He found Reish Lakish, who was his chavrusa, brother-in-law. So he found his child, which is Rabbi Yochanan's nephew, the Yosef Va'oma. He found his nephew was reading the following pasuk. And again, it's a pasuk from Mishlei. And the pasuk reads, Iveles Adam Tisalef Darko, a person's evil. A person's foolishness to Salef Darko can ruin things for him. Sometimes a person gets himself into a mess. The Al Hashem is after he goes and he gets angry at Hashem. He ruins things for himself and then he looks heavenwards and says, Hashem, why did you do that to me? He goes out all winter without a coat or a scarf and then catches a cold and says, what's the message? The message is get a coat. But he complains upwards. That's the pasuk. And then says the Gemara, Yosef Rabbi Yochanan, the Kamatama, Rabbi Yochanan, he was sitting and he was in wonderment and said, and let's see, these are the focal words, Mi'ikim midi dichtivi b'ksubi, can there be something that's written in ksubi, v'lo remizik araisa, and not alluded to in the Torah? And here, once again, he has now given expression to that idea. It is inconceivable that there is something formulated in Ksubim or Nevi'im that is not somehow found in the Torah. Amalei, so his nephew piped up and said, well, yes, you know, I think it is. Atu ha mina remizi, is this indeed not alluded to? V'haksiv, doesn't the pasuk say, we read it 3 or 4 weeks ago, with the brothers, when they found their food, they found their money had been returned together with the food. They were halfway home already. Vayetzei liban. Their hearts went out. Vayeferdu ish el achiv leimor, and they trembled one to the other and said, Ma zos asa elokim lom, what is God doing to us? So Rabbi Yochanan's nephew has actually told us a major chiddush. Because we know who's behind it all, because we know it's Yosef, but they don't know that, and therefore we think it's quite appropriate for them to say, you know, what's Hashem doing to us? Along comes the Yochanan nephew and saying, what do you mean, what's God doing to you? Why didn't you check your bags before you left? Why didn't you pack like a mensch? You didn't notice anything bulky or clinkly in your luggage as you were leaving? What are you looking upwards for? Check your things before you leave. So you brought this on yourself, and then you Al Hashem Yizaf Libo. I think that's a major chiddush in the pasuk. So be it. But once again, we see from this Gemara, it is stated emphatically, can it be something in the Ksuvim that's not alluded to, embedded in the Torah? There can't be, because that's what Ksuvim does. That's what the Nevi'im do. They elucidate things. By definition, if it's in the Navi, you'll find it in the Torah. And indeed, this, as many Mefarshim point out, Meshe Chochma, the Netziv, the Rabbi Kamenetsky, and others, explain that this is the idea behind the Gemara number 3, Maseches Nedarim, and Daf Kaf Beis, which says something which is so shocking, and it's impossible to explain it really any other way. Amar of Abba Rabbi Chanina. Abba says, Ilmale Chatu Yisrael. Had Yisrael not sinned, that is to say, Bnei Yisrael, not sinned with the Egel, Lo Nitam Lahem Ela Chamisha Chumashei Torah V'Sefer Yerushua Bilvad. They would have only received the Chumash, Chamisha Chumashei Torah, and Yerushua. I mean, everyone's going to know where they live, so fine, right. Yerushua. But they wouldn't have received anything else, no Tehillim, no Mishlei, no Yeshaya, Yirmiyah. So just to restate that, the Gemara is saying, had we not sinned, we would not receive the Vim Ksubim. That sounds slightly counterintuitive. It sounds a bit backward. It sounds like it worked out well for us that we sinned with the Egel, because otherwise we would have lost out on all that Torah. We would have been deprived. So how could these two meet? Sin is rewarded with more Torah. We normally say, mitzvah gereres mitzvah, avera gereres avera. Here, egel gereres levim exuded. So the Mefarshim, what the Gemara is saying is, we would not, had we not sinned by the egel, we wouldn't have missed out on anything. We wouldn't have received levim exuded, we wouldn't have needed levim exuded. Because what levim exuded do is all those aspects of Torah that you can't exactly see there, they're not apparent to the naked eye or to the untrained eye. So you need the living Suvin to elucidate them for you. Had we not sinned the Egel, we would be able to see them ourselves. We would be able to get all of those messages we wouldn't need, not Dov HaMelech, not Shlom HaMelech, not Yishaya, not Yirmiyah, nor Yechezkel to present them to us. And in fact, I think that this may explain to us something else. The fine point. There is an expression, you may have heard it, which sometimes people use it quite popularly nowadays. They say, when they talk about like a particularly gishmak of our Torah, they say, V'hayu hadvarim smekin kinesinosim b'sina. You've better heard that expression. V'hayu smekin kinesinosim b'sina. Think that the words were joyous as when they were given at Sina. I wonder if you've heard that expression. It happens to be, as far as I know, that expression, which is from Chazal, appears only twice in the entire literature of Chazal. Once in the Yerushalmi and once in Medrash Rabbah. And let's see both those cases. I think there's a fine here. There's a dimension here. The Yerushalmi Maseches Chagiga, which is quoted by Tosus, which is source number 4, and it tells actually the story, the background of Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya is a very famous person. He took a wrong turn a couple of times, and he's very, very complicated. But the Yerushalmi tells of his beginning. It actually tells the story of the day of his bris. And the Yerushalmi recounts that all the Gedolim were there, his father, Avuya, invited all the Gedolim in Yerushalayim, so they're all there, but the bris got delayed. Some things don't change. The risk of this wasn't happening on time exactly. So, a lot of people just they started eating and drinking. Some things really have not changed. When in doubt, So Rabbi Lez and Rabbi Yeshua were there. And they'd already eaten, I guess. So they said, well, okay, they're involved in their enterprise. We should be involved in our enterprise. So they sat down and they started learning. And the Gemara says that soon enough they were surrounded by fire, which caught the attention of Avuya, whose house it was, because they basically started a fire in his house. So he approached them and basically said, have you come here to burn my house down? Those are the words of the Yerushalmi. So they said, no, but let us explain. We were sitting and learning, and their words are, if we see in source number 4, just the middle line towards the end, Amr al-Chas v'Shalom, no, okay, we would never burn our house down. Ella, Yoshvim Ha'inu. We were sitting. V'chozrim divrei Torah mitorah l'nevi'im. We were reviewing divrei Torah from Torah to Nevi'im, and Nevi'im l'kstuvim. V'yod var smechim k'nesiyot of the Sinai. And the words were as joyous as they came out from Sinai. So we said to Rebbe and Yeshua, apologies, but you know, when the Torah was given in Sinai, it was given with fire. There's no Sinai without fire. And therefore, because we replicated Matan Torah at Sinai, so the fire came. Wow. Avuya was very impressed. That's why he sent his son to learn. Because Yerushalmi says it was Shiloh Shema. But what we do see is that these words, this expression, which then becomes very popular, by Dvarim Snechim Kinsinasa Sinai, was said when they were learning from Torah to Nevi'im and Nevi'im to Ksuvim. And I think that's very significant. And the reason why is because the only other place in Chazal, which is the Medrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah in Parsha Aleph, which also has this expression, Bahayu Dvarim Snechim Kinsinasa Sinai, is for the same reason. The Gemara tells us that Ben Azak was learning, again surrounded by fire, and Rabbi Akiva approached him and says, what's with the fire? And Ben Azak says, I was sitting by Sichores, Chose, Chores, reviewing, weaving, threading, the Torah, the Nevi'im, the Nevi'im, the Ksuvim, Lahayim, Adram, Smith, and Kimstinos, and Messina. So what we see in both of these cases is that this incredible label or title or level of Hadvarim Snehim to the Sinasa Sinai, in both the only two places it features in the word Chazal, it accompanies a certain type of learning, which is referred to as going from Torah to Nevi'im and Nevi'im to Ksuvim. And I believe that what that means to say is Nisinasa Sinai was before the Chet HaEgel. But before the Chet HaEgel, you didn't need Nevi'im and Ksuvim, as the Gemara and the Dharm tells us. You could derive everything from the Torah. The idea of going from Torah to Nevi'im and Nevi'im and Ksuvim is basically they began the Torah, and they saw these things in the Torah, and they said, oh, and that's what it says in the Navi. Oh, and that's what it says in the Ksuvim. And they basically were learning on the level of Sinai, on the Prichat HaEgel level. You can see it in the Chumash, and then you're able to see where that was elucidated, but you can find where it is in the Chumash. That's Sinai. That's what I believe that is the understanding of why it's used in those places. Altogether different Madriga. And the MS, you should know that this is probably the understanding of another Yerushalmi in Maseches Megillah, which is quoted by the Rambam. In the end of Hilchos Megillah. And the Yerushalmi says, in the future, all Nevi'im will be discontinued. Kol Sifrei Nevi'im Asirin Libatel. Except for Megillah Esther. You could not do that Megillah Esther. But all other Nevi'im Asirin Libatel. Now you know, there's someone who tracked the Rambam very closely, and whenever he was upset about something the Rambam said, he told you, and that is the Raivad. And here the Raivad is upset. And the Raivad says, with the signature Omar Avram, how can this be? What? There's so many things to be learned from Nevi'im and Ksuvim. How can they be discontinued? However, the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh and Rav Shlom HaLevi Alkavetz in the Perish Banos HaLevi to Megillas Esther, both on the same Pasuk there, they both lived in Svat. Or at almost the same time, they're both landsmen. Although that's probably not what they called it in Svat. But and they both say, no, it closes the circle. Before the Egel, we didn't need to be an student to learn it from the Torah, and that's how it will be again in the future. When it says, it's not that we'll lose out. We'll get back to that level that you're able to see it in the Torah. You need Megillas Esther because that's a mitzvah to read the Megillah. We can't substitute for that with all the other Megillah Ksuvim. And so, through these Bekeros and Ten Nechacham, the Chachamah, the Yechavot, really develop for us this fascinating idea. I think it changes the way you look at the Vyamiksutta. The Vyamiksutta, we now know, we are armed with a piece of information that is axiomatic to the Gemara. And that is whatever concept or principle you find in the Vyamiksutta, you should be able to find it in the Torah. It's there in the Torah. We may need help, but it's important to realize that it's bringing out something in the Torah. I mention this specifically with reference to a certain idea that was very beloved on the Kuperman, and that's the idea of Derecher Darchei Noam. Derecher Darchei Noam, which is also a pasuk in Mishlei. I mean, the source is not the song, you know, in Shul before the Torah. The Derecher Darchei Noam is also a pasuk in Mishlei. And Rav Kuperman wrote at length, and we always talk about it, Derecher Darchei Noam. And it means the Torah's ways are ways of pleasantness. And if we think about it carefully for a moment, once again, we now know that whatever is formulated in the Vyamiksutta can be found in the Torah. Well, where do you find Derecher Darchei Noam in the Torah? And the answer, actually, is everywhere. And thus began Rav Kuperman's search for Derecher Darchei Noam, and he turned up with dozens and dozens of examples. It's one of his prakim in Chutta Shel Mikra, Derecher Darchei Noam, with Rabbi Lubachia and then Meshech Chachma, and everyone in between. And each one in their own way, the way the Torah writes about things. It doesn't mention Hashem's name with regards to bad things, only with good things. Because if bad things happen, that's not the point, that's not the idea. The good things should happen. Derecher Darchei Noam. Reasons that Mefarshim give for mitzvahs. Derecher Darchei Noam. And it can even affect the halacha. How could it happen? It can even affect the halacha. So clear is it to the Gemara. No, what we, the Arba Minyan on Sukkos, they're not called Lulav Esra Kadasim and Aravos in the Torah, although they are at Unkelus. If you ever wish to be encouraged in your study of Unkelus, start with that pasuk. You'll know all about it. But for the pasuk calls it Kriyas Hadar, Kafas Tumbarim, and the Gemara says, well, what? And Anafe Zavos. What's Anafe Zavos? What's the. What is that? So we call it Aravos. Pardon me, Hadassim. So the Gemara says, well, you know, there's another type of plant called Hirdus, which also has the same characteristics. Maybe it's that. Could be. Could you be yotzi with that? Says the Gemara, no, because it has very sharp edges. Not nice to hold. Derecher Darchei Noam. If the Torah's going to make you hold one of those, you've got Hadass in there. And Derecher Darchei Noam carries the day. And based on Derecher Darchei Noam, you will absolutely not be yotze. If you pick up one of those here to fit, you've got tzaras. You've got, scabs on your fingers, and you won't yotze the mitzvah. I don't know which is worse. Because Derecher Darchei Noam. And you see, therefore, and this is what Rav Kuperman emphasizes, that when Shlomo HaMelech says it's a reciprocal thing, when he says Derecher Darchei Noam, how does he know that? The answer is, well, he's Shlomo HaMelech, he learned the Torah. But now that he's told us that, if we take that principle and we learn the Torah with it and through it and explain things based on it and even pass the halachas based on it. I think it's fair to say that Rav Kuperman himself could actually be summed up with those words, Derecher Darchei Noam. All his ways were Darchei Noam. I must say, I've had a lot of time to think about Rav Kuperman over the last year. I spent a great deal of time with him. I had a chavrusa with him which went for 25 years. And I learned a lot from him. He spoke to me about many things. And I must say, it often struck me to wonder, you know, we see all the things he did. I think the first question is, like, how did he know that he could do that? And who told him he could do that? Who told him he could set up Michlana? Who told him he could write Chutta Shel Mikra? Who told him he could... How did he get to be the way that he was? He seemed to come out of nowhere. Started relatively late in terms of yeshiva. father wasn't a Rosh Hashiva. And I think it largely remains a mystery. But as we know, Rav Kuperman always encouraged everyone to find their place. And when he, therefore, guided by that, when he saw his place, he knew that's where he needed to be. When he saw what needed to be done and he could do it, there was no looking out. But as much as it remains a bit of a mystery, where did he come from? I think there are certain trademark characteristics of his that not only can we appreciate with him, but that we can learn from him, which I think is important. If we stop and ask ourselves, can I learn anything from Rav Kuperman? Can I emulate him? The answer is yes and no. Here's the no. Can I write a parish on the Mishnah Chachma and the Sforno and grammar can work four volumes on Pshuto Shel Mikra and Sefer Shoftim and Sukkiyos and the Talmud Min Halacha and Balei Paltas, as well as setting up a school that changes the face of Torah education for women in Israel and beyond, and sets up hundreds and thousands of teachers and students? No. But, or probably, but, can I emulate Rav Kuperman in any way? Yes. I think he had certain things that he did that we absolutely can pay attention to, and it will be a tiferes lezichro if we think perhaps to incorporate them in the way we do things. The first thing I think we need to know about Rav Kuperman, and if you ever saw him, you'd know, he never seemed frantic or harried or overly anxious about anything. He only ever did one thing at one time. And for us, that's such a foreign concept. I think it's a different generation. There are only, nowadays, the whole concept has been completely reversed. And we lose. We take our inspiration from our machines. And they can multitask. And they're successful, so maybe if I try and do everything at once, maybe I'll be successful. With the collapse of human role models, machines take over as they're doing everything else. And that's the question for the aspiring one who wishes to succeed. Masai yagiu masai la masai ha computer shell. When will I be able to emulate my computer? Successful in so many ways, and look at me, it can do 12 things at once. I can only do one thing at once. And we try and do everything, we end up with nothing. And we look at people who only do one thing at a time, and we feel that they're left behind. And then a short while later, they pull ahead, and we're behind. Rav Kuperman only ever did one thing at one time. And what's really amazing about that is, whatever he did, he devoted himself to it 100%. And I think the reason why is because he believed totally in everything he was doing. And because he believed in everything he was doing, he felt it deserved his entire self. Which means he took care of all aspects of the Mechala. Certainly in the early days, he told me he would be schlepping chairs and turning off light. But he did it with the same dedication as he wrote his parish on the Mishnah Chachma. Because it's part of what needs to be done, and he believes in what he's doing, and gives it 100%. We're so preoccupied, even before we've actually done anything. Preoccupied is more a nervous state or an existential state than it is actually doing anything. So whatever we do, there's not that much of us left available to connect with. So there's something we can learn from the people. Whatever we do, we should first of all ask what we're doing. That's the first question. Is what we're doing important? Maybe it's not, and maybe we shouldn't do it. But if it is, then we should do it, and we should do it fully. And moreover, not only was this true with everything he did, it's true for every person that he met. I think every single person here who met Rav Kuperman knew that when he was talking to them, you got 100% of Rav Kuperman. Because people were important to him. Every single person he met was important. whether he knew them or whether he was the third being seduced by them. It doesn't matter. When you stood in front of him, you got the whole work of him. And it was amazing. You'd never imagine that he had anything on his mind, including running his school, taking care of everything that was going on, reprinting a sefer, writing another one and correcting. You'd never know that he had anything. You think all he has in this world is to talk to you right then at that moment. Some people, especially if they're, I would call it, choshua people, which it's a good thing to be a choshua person, but they've got so much going on. When you speak to them, you kind of feel that 90% of their, I would call it, RAM space is really taken up with other things. There is a maximum of 10% available for anyone that they're talking to at the moment. Maximum. Not guaranteed. It can never go higher than 10. It can go lower. And if it goes lower, you go lower. You may end up with 3 or 4%. And that's called a successful meeting. And on the one hand, you can understand they've got so much to do. Rakuban also has so much to do. But at the moment, he's talking to you. Which means at the moment, he has nothing else to do except to talk to you. I had this experience every week because I would turn up and he had a whole procession of chavrusas. There would be Ach Yatzo Yatza, Zenitnas, Zenyatza. We would tag each other on the way out. And it was one after the other. My hour was 6 o'clock, 6 to 7 on Thursday, and 6 to 7, there was nothing going on in his life except learning anything. You could see, he absolutely was, and these were things actually that he'd learned before. I didn't know at the time, but he has nothing to do except learning to do. It was completely wrong. And what was amazing is, quite often the phone would ring, you can imagine, the phone would ring, especially around Yom Tov time, it was an epidemic. Before Pesach and Rosh Hashanah, it rang off the line. And he would answer. And it was amazing to see. Because as soon as he picked up the phone and started talking to whoever on the other side of the phone, he's 100% with him. You can do something else in the meanwhile. He's not learning to do that. He's talking on the phone. He's 100% with him. Instantly, he knew who they were, placed them, and imagine how many Talmidos he had. Place them new to ask out after in their family, Mashbam Harabanit, Mashbam Yofi, 100%. She would have got off the phone feeling like $1 million. He was 100%. And then he put the phone down and he was 100%. Wherever he turned with 100%. To whatever enterprise and to whatever person. That's why everyone remembers what he said to them. That's why everyone was so impacted by their meetings with him. Because he got the whole person. For that moment, imagine Rav Kugelman, his whole life. He didn't get his whole life. But for 30 seconds, he got the whole person. I think that one of the amazing things about Rav Kugelman is that he managed to fuse and to blend humility, simplicity, and dignity. On the one hand, there were no frills. There was no what I call chashivishkeit with him. You know, if he didn't get shlishi, if he didn't get the brach under the chuppah or something like that, he wouldn't go into a state of whatever. Not at all. He never wanted it or needed it. Even I was with him in many family simchas, and I saw how people looked to him for a bracha. And you look around to see, is there anyone else who needs the bracha? And if he did, he kind of very, very naturally, it was a very beautiful thing to behold, how he looked for someone else to respect them. And he would shy away from it. There's different ways to shy away from kavod. Some people shy away from kavod, they're such a ruckus when they shy away from kavod, they can hear it in the next neighbor. Clonies avoiding kavod again. But Rav Kugelman is so natural, so seamless. It was so, with such warmth, and he just guided you to whoever would appreciate more to get that product. But on the other hand, as much as he had this, I would really say no airs and graces, but he was full of dignity. He never did anything in a way which was not dignified. It's an amazing combination. I would even say, and Rav Kugelman, if you ever know how, remember how he used to talk about the accents you put on things. Bitochon or Bitachon. World of difference. I think it's apt to say about Rav Kugelman, there's two concepts. Kovod and Kabul. Recruitment had no sense of Kabul. Kabul in the sense of, did they honor me enough, did they, and all that. But he was full of Kabul. He was full of honor. Still waiting to carry himself. And I believe the reason why is because he held that what he was doing was more important than he was. He held his goal to be higher than himself. And because that's true, he acted with dignity out of respect for what he was doing, but never demanded cover for himself because it was never about him. It was always about what he was doing in the service of Am Yisrael, Torah, Chinuch, and all of those things. And that's why the two went together. He commanded such respect because he himself was in such respect of what he was doing, he couldn't help but respect him as the conduit, but it was never diverted towards him. The lost art of really true humility. Because true humility goes together with dignity. But you're humble because something's more important. You have to act with dignity, out of respect for what you're doing. You know, another amazing thing about Rav Kupperman, I could really, really go on at least to, well, not to Kriyas Shema Aretz, but just another one or two points. What's our apparent time? Yeah. The amazing thing, another amazing thing about Rav Kupperman is how open he was to hearing a new idea, a new Torah insight. I don't know how many of you ever visited his house, maybe if you were in his Mishal Chachma Club or you were engaged while you were in Mishal or something. He had his desk, and next to his desk he had a small table. I don't know if you remember this. A small table. On that table were at least a dozen Sfarim, and they were publications that he was basically working his way through. And this was true when he was in his 60s, and his 70s, and his 80s. That table was still there when he passed away. And the bookmark was moving. And these Sfarim were written by people who he probably taught their grammar. Like, it's a good sefer, he probably taught their grammar. So what can they possibly tell him? He has literally written the book on how to learn Kurdish. And here's some no one, some youngster barely discovered Tanur Rabbanan by the time Rav Kupperman was already publishing Pshita Shem Mikra. Can you teach me anything? Said Rav Kupperman, I hope so. He's going through all these spots with a new insight, and he found one, he'd be delighted. And I know from my own experience, and I was just stunned, you could walk away, you could weep. See how he, although I knew his Torah very well, I've heard it from him many times, and sometimes I had kashas on it, and I had alternative thoughts about it. So there was a bit of trepidation, you know, he's so much my senior, I'm less than a fraction of him, he's Rav Kupperman, he knows everything. Can I talk to him about it? But I decided to try, and invariably, it was just to see him listen to someone who's nothing, who doesn't know almost nothing. So he listened, open. He knows I'm suggesting something that's different than the way that he suggested it. The openness, and sometimes he would accept it, and sometimes he would correct it, and sometimes he would reject it, but if he didn't tell me why, most people, they stop listening to a new idea probably by their late teens. And that's considered slow. And here's Rav Kupperman, 70 years old, 80 years old. Someone has a new idea on something that he's been through 100 times. He's open. We should be that open to new ideas. Perhaps I would sum up by relating something that was told to me by a Talmud of mine. Once a year, I used to bring my Talmidim to Rav Kupperman's house for a shiur, just because I felt he wasn't busy enough. And so I'd like to take the boys on shiur there. Where am I going to take them? I'll take them to Rav Kupperman. They'll never sing anything like it. not before and not again. And I would give them my hour. And the first year I did that, was the first time we tried it, and to see how he welcomed them in, it was unbelievable. A bunch of strangers, it's a lot of things he needs, it's the end of the day, it's the end of a week. He's got Michal on his head, and in troop, a bunch of guys. He sits them down, he greets everyone individually, where are you from, what are you doing? Everyone's at home, like that. Everyone's at home. What are you doing? What's your degree? Like, some years I think he still ended up with more degrees than the whole table put together. And that's that. He gave him a shir. The shir would be an ayat as ayin, or a shibatat, or a shibapeh, you name it. A couple of years later, I met a Talmud of mine who had actually stayed on for another couple of years in yeshiva. And it was Simchas Torah actually, it was a Kiddush that we were schmoozing, me and him. And he said to me, you know, I have to tell you, I've never told you this. The reason why I stayed on in yeshiva for another 2 years was because of that shiur we had with that cooking. And I'll tell you why. In other words, it was a brilliant shiur, it opened our eyes and all of that, but that's not the reason why. The reason why is because I just saw how he was. I just saw the way he did things, the way he spoke, and the way he did everything. And it was clear to me that he's like that because of all the Torah he's learned. He's ingested it, and he's internalized it, and he lives based on it. And I said to myself there, and I said, how would you like that? And if it takes learning Torah to make you be like that, I've got to say, Rav Krugman never knew. He just by talking to someone inspired that person to stay another 2 years in yeshiva. Because that's what Torah makes of a person. I'm in for another 2 years. And that's also very important. Sometimes people who are academic, there's a disconnect in a sense between the knowledge they know and the way that they are. Quote one of Rav Krugman's favorite expressions, never the twain shall meet. And yet Rav Krugman was an absolute fusion. That all the learning lived by it, but the ideas that came in, they became part of him. And so, again, plenty more to say, but we have to say a die at a certain point. But I think the greatest tribute, really, in addition to appreciating Rav Krugman, the greatest tribute is maybe take some of these lessons. Because in whatever we do, hopefully it's important. But sometimes we can't really bring ourselves to be invested 100% in what we're doing, for whatever reason. And so that Rav Krugman may be an example for us. And that if the things that we're doing are important, they deserve 100%. And if the people that we're talking to are important, and everyone we talk to is important, as Rav Krugman taught them, they deserve 100%. That each person deserves. And I think we'll be amazed at what happens. We'll be amazed at what we see in terms of ourselves, in terms of other people. So it's really very, very difficult to, I'll tell you, the day that Rav Krugman passed away, and I was kind of driving, I probably should not have been driving on that day, and I thought to myself, because I could not imagine, when he was alive, I couldn't imagine, you know, the world without him. He's like so much a part of the way that you see things, and the way that you talk about things. I couldn't imagine, you know, imagine like the world without him being there. I couldn't imagine it. And then one day he wasn't there. So then I had a bit of a conversation in my head between one side and the other. And so one side said, no, so is it the end of the world? The world's still here, the world still goes. But then the other side said, yeah, the world still goes, but it's not the same world. Different. But perhaps what we owe to Rav Krugman is to try and take, you know, what he taught us, for example, through his teachings, through his writings, through all the different conversation, and perhaps to try and keep the world as much as we can the way that it was when he was here. And the way that we do that is through emulation, to try and express his teachings. And every time we do that, and every way we do that, it should be Ilu, Shmoso, the Teferes, and Zichro, the Yizikro.
Well, yeah, it's only probably, it's like a small pamphlet one, yeah. Yeah.
It's important. It's not worth it. It's more important to me not to be the person who's doing it. Because I really don't.
Yeah, but not yet. I'm really sorry. Dr. Kronenwasser asked me to say some memories of Ralph Goodman, but after Rob Bernstein has spoken, I felt even more inadequate to say anything. But I will just say a couple of things. And I remember when I had my interview years ago in Cosmodium, and I had no clue what I was getting myself in for anything, but I only applied to my fellow. So I knew that if I messed it up, that was it. I wasn't going to stem or say whatever or anything. So what am I going to do? So I stood outside Mr. Cohen, office, absolutely petrified, not having an idea of who I was about to meet or see, because I hadn't seen any pictures of him or anything. And suddenly the girl came out, who was in front of me, and she had a smile on her face, and she said, "Deborah, don't worry, it's absolutely fine. He's really sweet, he's got a long beard, and you just want to give him a cuddle." And I'm like, "Oh, fine, okay, fine." So I go in there and I look, and his piercing eyes just were so warm, and his beard, as she had described, and I just wanted to give him a cuddle. I didn't, I restrained myself, and he said, "Don't worry," he said to me, "don't worry." He said, "Just take a seat, make yourself comfortable, relax, it's all okay, you're going to be fine." And I was thinking, he's really not so bad. And I remember I had to read a Russian bracelet that I can't remember whether I got it right or wrong or whatever. That I just left that room feeling a little bit less inadequate than I did at the beginning, feeling, you know what, maybe I do have a chance of getting in, just by the way he spoke to me, and just by the fact that I think there was something. He opened the interview letter, not the interview, the what's it called? I had to write a reference, and my brother wrote a reference. And he smiled and he said, "Don't worry, you'll be okay. I'm going to learn with you next year." And I was like, "Oh, right, okay, that was easy." And I walked out. Anyway, Baruch Hashem, I got in there. But then we get to the challah, and there's this, I don't know if any of the Brits remember this, but there's this big thing about the Americans, and it's quite daunting because you're like, these little English girls, there's like 10 of you, and there's about 120 Americans, and we were quite nervous about them because they do get a little bit carried at times. No disrespect to any Americans in the room. And so about a month into it, where we've seen that the Americans kind of like knew the whole Chumash and enough and everything, absolutely everything called, and us Brits, who didn't have a terrible education at Hasanian, but just had no, it was a very good education, don't get me wrong. My mother worked loved that for Hasanian. But we were on a bit of a less level. But then we did A-levels, and they didn't even know how to count to three. So we get this message, "Rav Kuchner wants to see you." So we all got really nervous. We thought, we're not coping, we're not managing what's going on. So there's 10 of us that trips in up the stairs to the top, all the way to the end of the corridors there, and we go into Rav Kuchner, and we knock on the door, we're all really scared. We think, okay, we're not really leading up to this, like, whatever. And we walk in, and he sits us down, and he welcomes us, and he said, "I just want to check that you're all okay. I know it's very difficult coming from England. I'm Irish, I understand, I speak the same language as you, blah, 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 blah. I just want to check that every single one of you is managing, and that you're coping, and that it's not too difficult, and I know that you don't speak as good Hebrew, etc., etc." And our mouths just dropped open. Like, you know, you have 130 students here, and have singled us out to check that we're okay. And I don't need to say more than that, because that was Ralph Cookman. We were his daughters, he cared about us, and he wanted to check that we were okay. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore, but my partner is coming. But before, I just wanted to say one more. I feel very... I must tell you, when I accepted this, I didn't know that there were going to be men in the room. I actually didn't know that there was going to be any women speaking. I thought it was like a little nechala get together, just women and whatever. And my husband said, you accepted, you're not backing out now, your name's in the paper. I do feel very inadequate in front of all these kosher rabbonim, and but just that I wouldn't know, I'm sorry. But then maybe with hopefully making enough Christmas plans and as a child I was doing what we need. Right, there's a pasuk in Daniel that says, "I have a feeling that he would desire her up here, and that feeling her up in Kachavin Nylon Guide. That the wise will shine like the brightness of the sky, and those who bring the many to be righteous are like the stars forever and ever." So ask the Gemara, who are the Masdikei HaRabim? And the answer is, the teachers of children. Why, though, are the teachers of children compared to stars? So my husband told me that he once heard the following explanation. If you go out on a bright summer's day and look up at the sky, you can't see any stars up there, but you know that they're still there. During the day, they're not visible, but they are still there somewhere in the universe. So too, a good teacher is like a star. Even when they are no longer around, the Talmud will ask himself, how will my teacher have guided me in this situation? They still have an impact on how the students live their lives, even though they're no longer present. These words encapsulate the essence of what it means to be a teacher. And I'm sure that I speak for thousands of our Kufner's pupils when I say that although he's sadly no longer physically with us, the enthusiasm, devotion, care, tolerance, and understanding that he invested into each and every one of us has never left and is shining brightly to this day. There's a beautiful moshul that can help us understand this further. There was once an incredible king who was an inspiring leader and loved by all. He ran the whole country with authority and professionalism. As he approached his 90th birthday, he organized a huge banquet in a grand hall and invited 5,000 people. Everyone was really anticipating an amazing party. When they entered the room, they all received a candle and a box of matches. No one understood why. This was the king's order, and no one dared disobey or question him. So what did everyone think? That the king was going to have a huge birthday cake, and they were all going to light a candle on the cake. In the middle of the grand hall hung a huge chandelier, so bright it lit up the whole room by itself. And the guests were eating and partying, and there was a very joyous festive occasion. But suddenly, halfway through the evening, the fuse box blew up and the chandelier went out. 5,000 people panicking in a dark room, absolute pandemonium and chaos. Very calmly, the king stood up by the podium and announces that no one should panic. Just take out your candle and light it, he instructed. All of a sudden, the room was even brighter than with the chandelier. Everyone wondered how the king knew that this was going to happen. Said the king, "This is no accident. I set the fuse box to blow. You see, my dear people, I'm very sick and don't even know if I'm going to live out the year. I was your chandelier. I did everything for you, but very soon I won't be here for you. I want you to learn from what I did. Everyone in my kingdom, every single one of you have some light. All of you are a candle. And when the big candle goes out, you have a light. You have to light your own small candle. If you all take on one small job, one small function, one small role for the country, then it will run better and better. This is the power of Am Yisrael. Together we can light up the world. One mitzvah can tip the balance and bring Mashiach. Each of us has our own talents, missions, and strengths. We no longer have major leaders to guide us. No Moshe, no Yeshua, no Rishonim or Acharonim, and sadly too few Gedolim. And then we lose leaders of great institutions like Nechala. Very few great leaders are left to guide us. Too few powerful lights. The chandeliers are being taken away, but you and I, each of us can become a light from the lessons that we have been taught throughout our lives." Perhaps the words of Rivka Saperstein, who I actually remember as an assistant in the Nechala Library, and now she's risen to the ranks of being a top chanechas herself, can help us tie up the ideas. She writes, "Most people in the world will probably not make as massive an impact as Rav Kukman, However, the lesson we can take is that we must live our lives with the consciousness that Hashem has endowed us with in order to have an impact to shape our world. By living our lives as sincere Avdei Hashem, we too can make an impact, and the trickle-down effect of those actions is inestimable. So to conclude, everyone has a gift in their hands to do something. Together we can give light to the world. If I light my candle from yours, it doesn't mean yours will be any weaker. Quite the contrary, we've all been blessed, especially those that have been to Mechalah, and we need to use our gifts to make a difference. Now, what we're going to try and do, if the video works, is try and tie up the light theme with a shiur that Rav Kugman gave on Parshas Vayeshev, which was about Hanukkah. We're going to try with the microphone. Ben's going to do that for us now. Oh, thank you, Ben, by the way, for coming.
Yeah. not very prohibitive to have an intervention. You must have already been for my Menachashim, like an aviation, to fish it out of the Hofer. And the Lusha Yusham Nachashim, like an aviation, Harish and the board, the top board, the Hashim, like a beam, which came to know Yazid to know, sell this, be hoots in the prayer teller, but said that I will say, Kishubazam, Mikmar, Terra, Buddha, Terra, Shasani, this, Amako, Nasa. Uhadi, Via Pida, Ezel Hanukkah. Great Madame, Hades, Hagato, Shil Hanukkah, Zerabim, Via, Natim, Tweim, זה הנס אדיר, כמו שאנחנו נותנים בתחום הלכות בתחילת הלכות חנוכה, שכתוב הוא סייע למכבים והחזיר להם מלכות ישראל לעוד כמאתיים שנה. נס אדיר בלי ספק. אבל הנס הזה אין מברכים. משום שהוא נס בתוך גבולות הטבע. עובדה היא שעד היום הזה יש גני ילדים מסוימים שעדיין שרים על הניסים ועל הנפלאות אשר חוללו המכבים. הם חושבים שמכבים עשו ניסים בזמן שצריכים לאולי נוסחה אחרת אשר עשה השם למכבים. הווה אומר, על הנס העיקרי של חנוכה אין מברכים. על מה כן מברכים? על הנס מגדולי. איזה נס מגדולי? של פח השם. זה שלא כדרך הטבע. אם זה שלא כדרך הטבע, על זה מברכים. היסוד למה שמשמעות מדבר כאן, הוא בוודאי בפני הרמב"ם. בסוף פרשת הוא, פרק י"ג, פסוק ט"ז, דיבור המתחיל הוא בתותפות בין ידעת, אשר שם הרמב"ם אומר שהקדוש ברוך הוא עשה את כל הניסים הגלויים של יציאת מצרים אך ורק כדי שנאמין בניסים הנסתרים, לשון אחרת, כדי שנתרגל לראות את השגחת השם בחיי היום-יום שלנו. ואומר הרמב"ן שם וגם בדרשה מפורסם שוטרן אשר תמימה מי שאיננו מאמין בניסים נסתרים, קרי מי שאיננו רואה את השגחת השם בחיי יום יום אין לו חלק בתורת משה. ביטוי חריף הממחיש לנו את החשיבות של השגחה הנסתרת, אבל עליה אין מברכים, רק מברכים על הנס שהוא מגדר
I remember many years ago that my father came in from Mazamir, a governor's meeting, and said to me, do you remember our apartment from Mesbalah? Remember, I said. I said, how could I forget one of Mesbalah's leading rabbonim that imbued so much Torah to us, and also a face that shined when he shared his wisdom with us? Rav Hartman, your lessons in the Maharal have not been forgotten, and in fact, when we got married, and my husband bought a set of Gur Aryeh, Ashaleh, from the Maharal Nikar with Rav Hartman's commentary in it, he was blown away that I had been zocher to have been taught by such a Talmud Chacham. So I'm sure I speak for hundreds, if not thousands, of pupils when I say that the roshan that you've made throughout your years as an illustrious educator is definitely Michalah's loss, but it's Chazmian's gain. But more than that, your shiurim attended by hundreds of people on a weekly basis have become a focal point of life in northwest London and have impacted on all of us greatly. So, Rav Hartman, thank you so much, because Rav Hartman just came from another share now. We had to try and work out the timings because Rav Hartman is so busy. And his topic is Harav Kupperman, Integrity Which Molded Generations of Talmidim. So,
In case you're somebody running, you sold that kind of the booklets at the back, they're for taking. It's in honor of your side, we took some of the classics, Malorin, and put them into English, and therefore please take, and if someone you think will learn and appreciate it, take another one for them, and we'll
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's very nice to see here the girls from the Salon. I recognize the faces. Baruch Hashem. I must say that I'm still, just to show what kind of kesha I have with the Michalan, since I'm here already for 10 years, every year I'm invited for 1 week to come to the Michalan. And they're just doing it, that's just to keep the kesha, they really don't need me. It's just, you know, it's recruitment for myself was not, it was a boss, of course, was a lot more than a boss. I personally own tremendous gratitude for myself. He offered me a job when I was 27, 28 years old. That's something like 5, 6 years ago. And he gave me the push. And then when I thought about doing the Avodah and the Maharal, the first person I called up, I remember it was Shabbos Parshas Tezriya, Tov Shem Ches. And I said, I was learning the grammar in Shabbos. I said, maybe there should be some kind of commentary done. Moitzei Shabbos, after Abdullah, the first thing is I called the Rav Kuperman. And I asked him, what does he think about it? He says, for sure. And he gave me such encouragement. And really, a lot of what I am, whatever it is, if it's good or bad, it's another story. But I owe a tremendous amount of gratitude. Yotzei Naklal. He's definitely one of a few people that played a major role in my life. He's definitely one of them. But I don't want to speak of my kesha with Kuperman, because that's really not the topic of tonight. And again, maybe we'll do it a different time. I spent with him many hours in different times, and there was a real ava and chiba between the two of us. Obviously, we were not equals. He was the rav, he was the mentor. I was a young man, but I very much cherish the time that I spent with him and his humility and his. The only thing his only chisson that he had was Irish humor. That's but otherwise, he was really. And I would like to point out, so again, not speak about the kesha that I have with them, which is a parasha in itself across the globe, I would like to speak about the three attributes that I think that Rav Kuperman had, the gavus. He had many, many minus. Out of the many, many minus that he has, I would like to single out three minus, which he had it not stop. He had it, the gavus, what Adam Gadol has. Point number one, I would like to speak about tonight is the feeling that he is a shaliach. And girls, this is something that we got to know. This was his Ramach Eberm and Shisa Gidim engaged, a feeling, I'm here, I'm on a mission, and I have a goal that has to be attached. Let's go a little bit into this Nakuda. The Gemara says in Maseches Chagiga, if the Rav is going with Tamalach, Yivak Shutoy Mepil. If the Rav is not doing a tel malach, then not. What's a malach? How does a malach look like? The Gemara says, I got to compare the Rav to a malach. Wings? What should be? What's the outstanding characteristic of a malach? I can double check if my Rav has it. So this is not my question, this is a known question. And most of the answers go around that a pein malach echad osei shnei shlokiyot. A malach is someone that he's totally consumed by that one shlichus that he has to do. Yes, he can be involved in other things as well, but his main concentration, focus, is on his shlichus. And Rav Kuperman definitely, that's what it was. Chinuch Bnei Yisrael was his essence. And when he got involved in other things, it was also at kama that could be helpful for him to be a mechanech of young women who Mitzvah Hashem become mothers and build homes in Am Yisrael. He felt this legamre. He's a shaliach. How many times did I hear from him that he quotes the Michtam Eliyahu on page, Prach Alef or page 20, that the Michtam Eliyahu says there, Misha obeyed b'inyan ha-nitzach l'tikun ha-oilam, if someone works on something which is needed for the world, zocher l'siyata d'shmaya yoter mi-madrigosay. He attains Siyata Deshmaya beyond his Madrega. Av sheino ra'ui la'voda hazot, zocher lekol ha'Siyata Deshmaya lo'oto inyan. Rabbi Bernstein, I'm sure you heard Rav Kuperman quote this. He quoted always. And he always felt, I don't deserve what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was successful for me to do. Look at this, I don't deserve it. But he always pointed out, in my time when he started the Mechalah, there still wasn't something so common. Chinuch Habanis, and he decided to dedicate his life to it. And he felt that since he's throwing himself into this shlichus, he's zochet to siyata d'shmaya way and beyond, which maybe otherwise he would have deserved it. But a malach is also manifested in another thing. Malach is, I always got to ask myself if I'm accomplishing my mission. And always come up with new ideas. And he goes, this is a massive, in the way we think in the Muslim culture, I think myself as a given. I get up in the morning, I'm a given. I have to do my work today, whatever. But on the large scale, I'm a free agent. Rav Kuhlman felt, I'm a malach, I have a shlichus, and I constantly got to double check, am I attaining and reaching my targets? And constantly think of new ideas. It's not just, I got a job to do and I'll do it. I'm going to have to one day report to someone about the shlichus that he gave me. That's what he felt. He once told me, we were speaking about there's issues going, always happening. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not going to demand of me or punish me for the girls that did not come from the Michala. He's going to hold me accountable for the girls who came from the Michala. And I got a job, and this is my shlichus, and this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to ask me one day. How do I do it? That's why Moshe had treated his life. And that's how he behaved. And therefore I remember once we spoke about the word Adnava, which of course was Adnava as well, but I'm speaking about the godless points. What does the word Adnava mean? So we looked up together, the Perish of Mishnayos of the Rambam, the Sukkah Speya. The word Adnava means the Anot. Who do you report to? You know, if you want to know someone, what's his status in the covenant, you ask him, who do you report to? Right? So, Anav feels that whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him, the more HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him, the more he'll be obligated, and he'll have to give a report. What did he do with it? You get a pound from someone, you don't need to report about it. You get 1,000,000 pounds, you want to report. If he gives you 10,000,000 pounds, how much more so? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we felt, gave him questions and helped him do this job, and he's going to one day have to give a report to the boss how he did his job. That's how we live day in, day out. Always with new initiatives. Always. You know, I'm sure you know better than me. This swarm these right. Well, we're going to do this one, and now let's do this one over again. And let's do the Meshachachman, let's go over it again. And always, we got to be Mechadish. I'm a Shaliach, I have a job, and the job has to be always being updated. And always ask myself if I'm doing the best I can. He managed to do that. There's another element of a shaliach. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to say, Mendaf ton, mit of ton. We gotta do. Accomplishment again. That's honestly, I'm doing what the Gospel will ask me to do. Will I be successful or not? Again. That's not my responsibility. I'm going to try my best to be successful, but that's already in the hands of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But this feeling that there's something, I'm here for a purpose. Now the Baal says in the Sefer Shtika, we're all shluchim. We're all on a mission. Ashrei Adam that could figure out what the shlichus is. And the Baal goes on saying, Ken ha kechometz la'inayim kechometz לשיניים, וכאשן לעיניים, כן העצר לשלוחו. Meaning, if you have the drive to do things, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you the seifa d'shmaya. If a person is na'atzel, lazy, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu loses the will, so to speak, to help him out. So, כחומץ לשיניים, like vinegar for teeth, I guess it ruins the teeth, and smoke for the eyes, which causes damage to the eyes, כן העצר לשלוחו. If a person's lazy about it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, does not want to bestow on this person, see, after the Shema, because he's lazy about it anyway, he's probably not going to do it. So what we have to show HaKadosh Baruch Hu is that we have the passion and we have the drive, and the rest is in the hands of Hashem. And I cannot think of someone more passionate and more on the drive than Rav Kuhlman. Even when he was already older and weak, always, let's do more, let's do the money, let's think about another idea, and we'll Mashal, always try to do the job of another point of a shliach is that you never got comfortable in this shliach. Whenever you start your job, you're full of idealism, you're very altruistic about it. You know, the first, yeah, but after 5-10 years, it's comfortable, this is my job. You never had that feeling. You never felt comfortable. Look at the deer they lived in. He could have bought himself one next to the deer and be comfortable. He had the most precious deer in the world. I'm sure all of us have nicer deers than he did. Because I'm not here to, it's a kind of school of thought that, I remember my father showed me something, and they hit it off very well with my father, that there's no mitzvah in the Torah to be comfortable. Where does it say in the Torah you're mitzvah to be comfortable? I remember when my father would tell me, I was a teenager, it would make my skin crawl. I would tell him, no, it's not easy, it's uncomfortable. What's uncomfortable? Mama's up. That's all part of the fact that Rav Kuperman was a shaliach. And shaliach osei shtei shluchugur, that's A, constantly worrying and checking out, am I doing my job? Constantly also defining my job. My job is the girls that come to me, those that don't come to me, I'm not going to be accountable for that. Regardless of that, was nefesh. I'm going to do my best, and the rest is in the hands of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And always, always like the first day, this pioneering kind of feeling of the first day already. Always with the new, and the excitement that he had when he gave a shiur. You would think he was giving shiur for 50 years. On the last day, the first day, he had the same excitement. And if a girl told him a chiddush, he would call me up and say, you can't imagine what today I heard. And share with me what the girl said. Such excitement, not dull, because he was constantly a shaliach. That's, I think, port number one that he had with Gavos. Port number two, he was allergic to sheker. Would you agree with that, Rabbi? Yeah, I'm putting you on the spot. No, it's not so nice of me. Things because that's what's expected of him. There were many things in his life that if he would have just taken the easy route out, he would have had an easier life. But he felt it's sheker. He felt that whenever he had issues with Misrad HaChinuch, which is sometimes a political kind of Misrad, and they wanted to do it this way, not that way, he says it's sheker. And the people that he held the most of were Anche Emes. And the ones he held the least of, if he felt it's a bluff, it's sheker. They're just doing it because it's the easy way out, or because that's what's expected of him. And for example, he purposely did not take a stand on the Medina. Is the Medina a Tata Gula or not a Tata Gula? He didn't take a stand. He called it constructive ambiguity. Remember that's what I used to call it? Namely, there's two shittas. And both are kosher. But you know, if you'll take a stand, you'll be able to attract more from that girl. No, I'm not going to take a stand because I'm going to think that both are building soil to Milan. What's my personal opinion? I don't think you ever told me. I can guess. But he's not going to take a stand on it. Now, if he would take a stand, this one or that one, he probably could have attracted more girls because he would be more defined as he's this. But it's shocking. And Rav Kuperman did not live a sheker. He buzz lize. Echo me baglit, who buzz lize.
He saved it.
You what?
He despised it.
To live with sheker. And his whole mahalach was also in learning. It has to be emes. It has to be emes. When other sevens were opening up, he did not care about the competition, but it bothered him a lot. When he felt that the motive was financial. When you're using Chinuch Bnei Yisrael for a financial gain, if you get a financial gain, fine, but it should be the practice. It should be the goal. It's the Dovish of Kedusha, and he had expressions on that. Yes, you know, from a certain point of view, he was a father image, and a father has to be emes. Maybe I'll just speak about this point for a moment. You know, the Ten Commandments, okay. Whatever. Kabeles Abicha, number 5. And then Lotirzach and Lotinaf. You know, the Rabbah explains what's the prohibition of Lotinaf. It's Pasha, it's your own body of words. What's the need to explain it? Says Rabban, you know it's a tragedy of Lotinov? Eshizish, whatever. So the child is going to call someone who's not his father, they'll call him father. And a father that's sheker is the most, is the epitome of anything wrong. A father has to be honest. That's a comment, juxtaposed to the comment of Michal Elechot. That's what the Rabban says there. If you're going to call someone who's not your father a father, that's the hipuch hagomor of emes. A father represents truth. A lot of things that we believe in is because we heard it from our parents. And it's true. A father doesn't like his children. Right? The Rabban says that how come it's such an important mitzvah to remember Maamen Har Sinai? The Rabban Shita is that it's a mitzvah. Because the first generation were there, and they sent over to their children, and avot lo yishaku lebnehem. It's against the core of our psyche. A father that lies is oh, I caught my father lying. It's terrible. If that could happen. And also from that point of view, Rav Kuman felt that he's a father to the girls, and you can't be sheker there. Anything that is a srach sheker, you totally didn't want to have anything to do with it. Ish emes. Okay. Another thing I thought that he was, I never saw anyone like it. Which the way it says in the Mishnah, because of his ezel chacham, hanoimed mikol adam, I never saw such a curious man that everything interests him. Any sefer, it could be Maral, it could be Divrei David, it could be Maskil David, it could be the Sforno, it could be the Meshech Chochma, it could be the Nachos Yaakov, whoever it is, it's a yenoto, it interests him. There's very few people like that. And the Rambam explains in that Mishnah, Ezel Chacham, Hanoim and Mikol Adam. That's exactly what Rukum was. He felt that he could learn from everyone. Says the Maral over there in that Mishnah, wouldn't it make more sense to say Ezel Chacham, someone who knows Shas? Someone knows Kol Torah Kula? Ezel Chacham, Ezel Shas. Why does it say Ezel Chacham, Hanoim and Mikol Adam? Explains the Maral, it has to be that something which is you. If I know Shas, it does not yet mean it's me. It has to be that there's a passion within me which gives me the attribute of a chacham. And that is the curiosity to learn from everyone. But if I learn only one kind of mahalach, so it doesn't mean that I'm really open to chachmah. Just that mahalach I like. But if someone is interested in everything, that shows a curiosity, a thirst, which is true chachmah, that I want to learn from everyone. And that's when the chachma that you have, when you have such a thirst for chachma, then it becomes a part of you. Rav Huda Zatzal once told me, a person doesn't grow from what he eats, but a person grows from what he digests. Which means it has to become a part of you. The enzymes have to take apart the food, and it becomes a part of you. That's what you grow from. But otherwise, if it's external, it doesn't become a part of you, so it's not really you. And therefore, if I know Shas, it does not necessarily mean it's mine. But if I'm willing to learn from everyone, and I have the curiosity, that shows there's a burning drive within me, and then you digest any material that comes your way, and it becomes a part of you. I can mention here, Rabbi Shapira Zatzal, my rabbi was lifted 2 weeks ago. The first conversation that I had with him was about exactly this nekuda, which we're personified. He told me, Rabbi Shapira, you go to yeshiva, you learn this derech, and you learn that derech, and you expose yourself to this rab and that rab. But at the end of the day, you have to come up with your own derech. You can't be constantly samuch al shulchan acher. You can't be nourished from a different table the whole time. It has to be you at the end of the day. And that's the tefillah b'sen chelkenu b'ser v'secha. I'll learn this derech, I'll learn that derech, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please help me find my chelek in Torah. Things have to become a part of you, not something external to you, because it's not you at the end of the day. For example, a wife, marriage. Chazal never said a wife's a partner. The truth is, that's a goyish concept. How many partnerships last? In business, how many partnerships last? And if it's a partnership, you're always checking out who's getting the better deal. If the partner brought in his son, so the other guy wants to bring in his son. And there's always a balance that has to be kept between the partners, that no one's taking advantage of the other. Chazal never said that the wife's a partner. Chazal said, Ish doi ki gufoi. Your wife is yourself. That's the sort of things become, everything at the end of the day has to become you. If it's not you, it won't last. And this, I remember I was spoken over once with Kukman Tzatzal, and he pointed out, Mamash this Nakuda, that, you know, if you say, if I'll tell you a joke, let's say it's a very good joke, so I'll tell it to you once and you'll laugh. A week later, I forgot that I tell it to you, and I tell it to you a second time, and you might laugh again, but a little bit less. After 3-4 times, you'll tell me, you already told me once. In fact, not only once, 4 times. It happens a lot in my shiur, if you can wear some batu. And the talmid, after a while, tell me, we got it. Said it. So when you hear a joke, you can hear it 3-4 times max. When you say a joke, if it's always a different audience, you can say it 100 times. And each time you have the same kishmak, right? That's a fact. Why is that so? Because when you're hearing a joke, you're hearing someone else. And there's a limit how much you can hear someone else. That's how we are. But when you're saying the joke, it's you. You could say 100 times. You don't get bored with yourself. Right? Everything that you do has to, at the end of the day, become a part of you. Like the Rashi says, and at the beginning of Pashas Noach, Eila told us Noach, these are the children of Noach. Noach was a great guy. Is that called the children of Noach? The next passage says, Noach had Shem Cham Yachas. So how do you stick it in the middle that Noach's a great guy? So Rashi has two explanations, right? The first one is, what's the first one? You paid so much tuition, no? Come on. What? מתוך שהזכירו סיפר בשיחו שנאמר זכר צדיק לברכה. And what's the second one? לימדך שאיתה אותו בסיים של צדיקים מייסים טרי. The main offsprings of a tzaddik are not his biological children. The main offsprings of a tzaddik are his good deeds. He was a tzaddik. And the biological children are secondary. They're mentioned later on. What's born when you do good deeds? Who's born? What's born? Says the Ramah, you're being born. When you have a son, and you're a son, whatever, you're being born, and you are, and it's more important to give birth to yourself than to give birth to others. Why? Because if it's yourself, it's real. If it's others, it's still not you. Everything has to come from you at the end. When you give birth to others, great, it's lovely, but it's still not you. Even your own children. It has to be you. The avoda is to connect to you, to yourself. Now why does Rashi say ikal to the same should tzaddikim ma'isim tovim? Why not ikal to the same should bnei adam ma'isim tovim? Why tzaddikim? Because a tzaddik does something with a passion, with a devotion. He's alive. And when he does something, that gives birth. If I put on tefillin in the morning like this in the morning, and I don't think about anything, nothing's born from that, I promise you. It's habitual, nothing happens there. It's like when I was 50 years old, I remember Shimon Schwab, he told us in New York that he spent one Shabbos with Chumatzai. And when he was 50, I was 50 years old then, he was 90 years old then, and it was Parshas B'Shalach, the Parsha of the Man. And there were a bunch of little kids around the table, 1929, 1930, by the Chumatzai. I wonder how many of those kids survived the Shoah. But the Chumatzai asked the kids, what did the Man taste like? So the kids answered, whatever you wanted, chocolate, ice cream, I don't know if they have pizza in Radim, but whatever. Ask them the Chofetz Chaim, and if you ate the man without thinking, say you're reading a book and you ate the man without thinking, what did the man taste like then? What was its taste? If you didn't think about a specific food, what did the man taste then? The kids did not know the answer. The Chofetz Chaim told, I'll tell you, I want to give you a yisoid for life. When you don't think, it's tasteless. And that's a rule in all walks of life. If you don't think, it's tasteless. Anything that we do without thinking, it's tasteless. That's it. Shabbos. Shabbos. Shabbos, what's Shabbos? You don't come, you know, I sit in the afternoon, chomp. It's a Shabbos over. And yet if I don't think, it's tasteless. If I put on full every morning without thinking, it's tasteless. But that tzaddik, when he does things, he thinks about it.
and he does it with a bang and a boom. Ooh, that's a lot of things happen then. Many, many births happen then. But Kukman Zatzal, he did things with a passion, with a drive, and whatever he did became a part of him. The Michalal became a part of him, the Meshechachma became a part of him, the Sforna became a part of him. Whatever he spoke to became a part of him. And then afterwards he would quote the people that he heard. It all was because everything he did was such an eagerness and with such a passion. And I think it's a manifestation. I have not encountered someone that was willing to listen to everyone with such a kacha, mamash kacha. A chavrusa. I have a director, can I come over to tell you? Betach! I remember when I started, I was 26 then, I had Kashas and Chumash, I used to send it there. Because my sister studied the Mechala. And I heard he knows Chumash. And he always answered, it's unreal. Whenever you send him a letter, he always answers back. So if he doesn't know, he has to do. And that's very, very uncommon. So those are the three points that I think, in my eyes, made Rav Kukman so miyuchad. The feeling of a shlichut, the being allergic to sheker, and that passion to internalize everything, which manifested itself, and I want to learn from everyone, and the way he listened, the way he wrote down, it just, and then the notes that he would write, leave your note in the box. Did you write it? I'm sure you know the teacher's box. Did you teach in the class? Yeah, okay. Every time I know there's going to be a note there from a woman, any suspect. It took me a while to figure out his handwriting, because it wasn't that question. There's always I am Paul, I am Sham, as if the man has all the time in the world. He was very, very miyuchad. And as long as we keep on his legacy of learning, and he always told me that Torah should excel for girls, it should be like Torah should appear for boys. Right? Remember a person that was his motto also. And the idea of that girls should have an understanding, a geschmack in their Yiddishkeit. And he really believed in it, and I think he had tremendous siyata geschmack. And all the girls that went through his moistness, are just a testimony. You know how you can gauge an institution? You will come into an institution, you want to know what's its level. You know what's one of the ways how to do it? I'll tell you a trick. Look at the library. That gives you the scope. The Michalas library is one of the best libraries in New Zealand. The girls, for their learning, do not need such a fancy library. They don't. And had everything there. English, Hebrew, Halacha, Agarata, Zoran, everything. Because that's what Rav Kukman was. The library is a manifestation of what Rav Kukman was. A man open to all and wants to internalize whatever he's learning and to make an impact in the world as much as a Kodesh Baruch Hu will enable him. So, Be'ezrat Hashem, we should keep on his legacy. I want to tell the girls here. You know, I can tell you that I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, which is the middle of nowhere, especially when I was born there. This is nothing. My father was a rabbi, so I don't know how, you know, I got there. I don't know how he got there. And my mother, Zosantin Steigman, who was alive and well, she made us learn from Mishmashi from the age of 5. She hired a rabbi in St. Louis, Missouri. I don't know where she found someone who knows Rashi. and the passion for Chumash Rashi, all the kids got it from my mother. My father was a big time chacham, but we didn't get this from him. You could do it at the Shabbos table. Then one year my mother was into haftaras. I had to know all the haftaras. But it could be done. It could be done. What I would say is, your girls in Kalah, and we have Rav Kukman as a model, do it. At the Shabbos table, make sure that your kids know Chumash Rashi. It's not that much to know. I'm shocked when I see that girls don't know Chumash Rashi. Boys, for that matter, as well. It's not such a big deal. And mothers can do it. My mother did it. In St. Louis, Missouri.
60609, that was a zip code. 738 Delmar Avenue, Kingsbury Avenue, I'm sorry, the show was the one. Yeah, you can do it. I promise you can do it. And I think that would be a beautiful way to keep on that passion, that rotzen, that livelihood, which Rav Kukman showed us. We should be zeichen mitzvah Hashem that, you know, next year hopefully won't have to be here again because there'll be chesed leisim mitzvah Hashem, and Rav Kukman will be here himself, and he'll keep on teaching us shuter shem mikra and the kishmak of every little rashi and katzuhumay mogros tilyan and all the differences and the meshech chachma and the sforno and all the things which are eternal. Yehi zichro baruch. Thank you.
Yeah.
He said Rav Kukman wrote it. Yeah, wrote it.